Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. Thanks for coming to our birthday party. It's actually tomorrow is the 34th birthday. It's hard to imagine back in 1989. Wow. And we're still here, which is even more important, but it's thanks to you all. So really appreciate your support and coming out, and appreciate John. We were at dinner trying to, you made some extravagant claim. We haven't actually done this together 60 times, but probably 30, maybe more.
More than that, because there have been more than 30 Prey books, and I've come here for the other ones, too.
Well, that's true. Not to mention, not the kid, I think. No, we did one kid. We did the fourth kid. We've done all the Virgils.
The fourth kid probably came out sometime in the early 90s.
Right. Right. And then I remember asking John why that was sort of the end of the kid, and it was because keeping up with the technology had become really difficult. And today it would be almost impossible. The technology is moving so fast that, you know, I tried to figure out, what is Elon Musk actually doing? I read today that he was interfering with something in the Mediterranean, like, was it Greece? I'm trying to remember. It was Germany. German ships in the Mediterranean doing life-saving or something. And I thought, why? I know. Money, yeah, it really is. And there's some interesting theories about whether, in point of fact, it's not really nations anymore, but major corporations, especially tech corporations, are really running the world. And, you know, government, although looking at our government, one can assume they're not actually running the country either. So, yeah, what can I say? All right.
No politics.
Sorry. Well, I was really thinking about it because we flew home from Quebec on Saturday, and we were going to get here just before at 11 something or other. If the government had dropped its funding, the question was, you know, if we were flying home on Sunday, whether we could actually fly, because the TSA, all those people, you know, suddenly would not be employed. So, I mean, it had a real-time question for us, but as it happens, we managed to get here. So we are talking tonight about Judgment Prey. Love the title. Do you decide what book goes with, what word goes with Prey, or is that a function of marketing at your beloved
publisher? That's a function of marketing. I have never thought of a single Prey title by myself. I've suggested some, and generally they're rejected. For the book that I'm doing, book that I'm doing next year, I suggested Viral Prey, because it has to do with viruses, and they rejected it, and it's going to be, what did I say it was going to be? I can't remember. There were a couple of different titles that they came up with, and they chose one of them, but they rejected my suggestion, and their suggestions were actually better. So that's not really a problem.
I live in fear that one day I'm going to pick up a thing and it's going to be called Final Prey. So I really don't want to see that title, John.
Well, you know, they tell me, the marketing people tell me that that's not going to happen. And they're going to also tell me that I'm never going to kill off Davenport. I can't have Davenport get killed. Well, the reason for that is because people stop once they knew what happened to Davenport. They would never read the earlier books, and actually, the earlier books make a lot of money for the publisher because they
hopefully for the author,
not so much really.
Really?
No, because we get paid up front, and a lot of the time, you know, and it's because we got to make that back. But at any rate, what happens is that the publishers, they get to a point where all they have to do is push a button and a factory someplace starts shooting out hundreds of books. And then they take them, distribute them to all the Barnes and Nobles and stores like this. And it costs them nothing, essentially, you know, $1 a book or something like that. And then they sell them for some enormous inflated price. And I don't get any of that money because I've been paid up front. So that's the way it works, basically.
Right. I said, yeah, well, that was a depressing. Sorry, I went down that rabbit hole. Okay. Let's move back to Judgment Prey. All right. So one of the things I really like about Judgment Prey is, you know, Lucas has been moving around in his role as U.S. Marshal. So he's been in various locations. But here we are back in the Twin Cities. We are in St. Paul and Minneapolis. So did you decide it was sort of a homecoming book?
It was a homecoming book, and also I had the problem of the Davenport and Virgil Flowers had both been badly shot up in the previous book. And you know, to have them running marathons in this one wouldn't have worked out very well, because Davenport had been actually shot three times, and once right through the chest. And so he, in this book, he's still kind of in a recovery mode at the beginning of the book when it starts. He's trying to run, but it's hard because he was shot both in the legs and through the chest. And contrary to what you see in the movies where somebody, you know, recovers from that in a matter of hours, it actually takes a while to get over getting shot in the chest with a rifle. That's one of the reasons I kept him in the Twin Cities. Also because I thought it was time to go back there for a while after rounding around Texas and Florida. Although the next book, the one that I'm just trying to finish now, is set in New Mexico. So that's also outside the Twin Cities area.
Well, so we have a jurisdiction question, which is if he's now a U.S. Marshal, how is he getting assigned to work a local murder?
You mean in the Twin Cities? Because that's where he's stationed. He works out of the Twin Cities office.
Okay, but I didn't know that U.S. Marshals got to work the kind of case that you have written about. So isn't there an interesting... I'm trying to get back into local politics here because there is a reason why Davenport is working this case.
Yes. A reason for the Davenport is working all of these cases is because it's essentially a political deal. That he has kind of a semi-corrupt political appointment as a deputy U.S. Marshal. It was fixed through a couple of senators every state has got at least one and sometimes more U.S. Marshals. There's one U.S. Marshal per state. But under them are all these deputy U.S. Marshals. And the deputy U.S. Marshals are really the people who do stuff. The U.S. Marshals, like a postmaster or is a political appointee. And what they did was they got Davenport because they owed him. A couple of U.S. senators owed him. They got him this appointment in which they said, just keep your mouth shut, help us out when we need it, and do what you want. And so that's his deal. And what he wants to do is he wants to hunt people that are hard to catch. That's just what he does for a living, and that's what makes him happy. And so he takes advantage of it, and every once in a while, one of these senators will come along, and they'll say, we've got a problem, you've got to fix it. And sometimes the fixes are semi-corrupt, and Davenport does it anyway because he likes to keep his job. There's a couple books back, three or four books back, it turned out that a really serious, ugly problem that involves some killings was touched off by a young woman, the child of a U.S. senator, who set up a phony website that all of a sudden caught a lot of attention from crazy people, and they killed somebody, including a young child. And Davenport covered that up in the end, although the killers were caught, of course, because they tend to get caught in my book most of the time. So Davenport is not entirely clean.
Okay. And also, if he's going to work with Virgil in this book, Virgil, in fact, he is operating in Minnesota, right? Virgil
yes.
can't necessarily...
Well, Virgil still works for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in
right.
Minnesota.
Right. So what is the crime that touches off the investigation in Judgment Prey?
One of the things we can't talk about too much in this for people who haven't read the book is what the solution is or what happens.
I wasn't going there.
Good. Because that's sort of... Because once there's a crime that takes place, which is pretty horrendous, a killer enters the house of a federal judge, murders the judge and his two young children. And there's a third person in the house, a baby who is not killed, but the two kids get murdered along with the father, shot down in a really brutal way. And the question is why? And there is an answer to this, which is should be obvious but isn't. And it's sort of a tricky thing, and maybe you'll figure it out, and maybe you won't before we get to the end of the book. But there's sort of a mystery involved here that takes them a while to solve.
Okay, so he's a federal judge, and so when this killing goes down, the judge's wife is not home, and the baby is spared. But obviously, when Virgil and Lucas come in to investigate, all the attention is focused on the judge, right? So that gives us a chance to excavate his cases and, you know, look for people who might have wanted to kill him. And as the judge, there are probably a lot of people that actually wanted to kill him. So,
and a lot of them, you know, are in prison. Some of them have just gotten out. The question is sorting through them, because, you know, like, this isn't giving away too much, but one of the guys that they're looking at used to be a gun dealer. And he's probably sort of a shady gun dealer. He was a private gun dealer. He didn't have a store or anything like that. He just dealt guns. And the question is, what was his involvement in this whole thing? And he's been out of jail not for very long. And his wife seems sort of pathetic. And there's just a lot of kind of complications like that. That kind of are piled onto the mystery. This is probably as close as I've come to writing a mystery, actually, rather than a straight-up thriller.
It's kind of an Agatha Christie thing, in a way, you know. But it's a very wide net, because a judge hears so many cases, and, you know, it could reverberate back for years. So I thought it was, it takes a lot of information gathering in a case like this. It took a lot of resources to be looking at, you know, people that he might have sentenced or people who would be angry with him or whatever. Meantime, his wife is involved in a local charity. So, you know, there's, as you all know, there are potential charity scams everywhere. So a question is whether the charity is legitimate or whether there might be something weird going on there.
I will tell you right up front that I think, and I knew this at the time I wrote the book, that some of the people were not going to like the end of the book. They don't like the ending of the book. They don't like the conclusion. Tough shit. What can I say? Yeah. The thing is that I like it. And I think a lot of people will like it, but I think some people won't like it. And,
we'll discuss that when you're here next time.
Yeah,
we can have a poll. How many people hated the ending of Judgment Prey?
I don't think people will hate it. They will think it doesn't follow, which is different than hating it. So.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that is true.
Well, there's a psychological element to the book, too, which I forgot. The psychological element is what leads to the conclusion of it. And some people may think that's too tenuous, but it's not tenuous if you're talking about somebody who's nuts. So
moving away from the plot, which I think would be a really good idea, since we're back in the Twin Cities, this is a chance for Weather, Lucas's wife, to have a voice. And Letty, who, as you know, has had now two books of her own, Letty is in the picture, but we also have Virgil, and Virgil doesn't actually live in the Twin Cities, does he? He lives somewhat south, and Virgil, if you've been reading the Virgils, which I truly love, has an interesting family relationship, let me put it that way, right? So part of this is Virgil's going back and forth, right, trying to keep up with the family at home and
right.
Up with the
Virgil now has twins, and young twins, and with his girlfriend, and she has had five or six other children, all by different men, and so she's got kind of this odd reputation, but she's pretty okay, and she fits with Virgil okay. I've got a number of problems that I'm going to have to solve if I write another Virgil book. I'm sort of coming to the end of my career. We had talked about this at dinner, and I am thinking I'm going to go to like one book a year. But what book do I go? Do I do a Letty? Do I do a Prey? Do I Virgil Flowers book? I haven't figured that out. If I go to one a year, but I've got an idea for a Virgil Flowers book called Virgil Quits. And what was your title? No, it was Patrick. Where's Patrick? What was Patrick's title? It was 2 weeks' notice. I think it was what it was.
That's it. Yeah, no, that is 2 weeks
notice.
Said,
yeah.
Right.
Is that which is better, Virgil quits or 2 weeks notice?
2 weeks notice, unanimous.
2 weeks notice. Virgil quits was my idea. Actually, see, that goes back to when we were talking about titles.
But 2 weeks notice leaves alive the possibility that he won't actually end up quitting. Right? It's not nearly as final, for example, as Final Prey.
But like you were saying, though, that it, you know, it starts a clock ticking. Will he finish his final case before the 2 weeks are up? And that was sort of the idea. But if I write that one, it's going to be a lighter book. It's not going to be a Prey book with. I mean, it's going to be more stupid than, you know, more stupid crime than vicious,
kind of,
terrible
that
crime.
That kind of fits Virgil. He's had some. I mean, I think about what's the one with the tigers called? That's my favorite, Virgil. What's it called?
Something other clause.
Escape clause. C-L-A-W-S is my favorite, Virgil.
Yeah.
I love that one.
Okay.
Right, because I critiqued you on the next one in which the serial killer, you were imitating Agatha Christie and you flunked.
Okay, well.
Right, but when I told John that, he said it was too late. The book was already published, so there we go.
The other thing is I hate Agatha Christie, so I don't mind flunking her. Although Agatha Christie was an interesting woman. She had some... she actually was married to an archaeologist who worked in the same area in archaeology that I did, which is over in the Middle East, and I worked for 15 years in the Jordan River Valley. And one of the stories, I can't remember what her husband's name was, but he was...
Max Mallowan.
Yeah, he was massively wealthy, and one day they were traveling cross-country from Damascus to Jerusalem, and her car broke down, and according to the story, Agatha Christie gathered up her stuff, went to a local tree, laid down, and went to sleep right in the middle of the desert. And that's when Max decided that he'd marry her, because anybody who goes to sleep under those conditions were, you know, somebody worth marrying. And
now she'd be the perfect archaeologist's wife. It's in her memoir called Come Tell Me How You Live, which is one of my favorite Agatha Christie's. And, you know, that's what she said.
And one of the stories about Max was that there are all these things called the American schools in the Middle East. There's American School of Athens, American School of Jerusalem, American Schools of Damascus. And they were like basically archaeology and history and American influence, and scholars would go there and study. And Max left... when he died, he left a bequest to the American School in Jerusalem, and there was widespread celebration because, you know, they were talking about all the good things they could do with this enormously wealthy man's bequest. And it turns out he only left them enough money to have a dinner in his honor every once a year. So, so anyway, that has nothing to do with anything except that I worked there for a long time and I enjoyed the stories. So
if you've been coming here for a long time, you will know that John actually sponsored worked on a dig in Israel for many years with photography. So why don't you, we were talking about whether or not his life was sufficiently interesting for him to write a memoir. Now, I know I've read lots of memoirs that written by people whose lives are not as interesting as John, so I'm all in favor of a memoir.
But the thing about a memoir is that first of all, I think the person who writes it has a sense of self-importance, and I don't really think that I'm that important. I mean, I really don't. That's always been my sense of things. That when I was a columnist, one of the things about newspaper columnists is that they've got to have a sense of self-importance, because why would anybody want to hear you talk? And that was my big problem. You got to write 3 columns a week. It's got to be about some topic of interest. And why in the hell would anybody know about 3 topics of interest a week? I mean, you know, like I can't even think about 3 topics of interest a year. And so I wasn't that good a columnist. But the same thing with a memoir, you know, you read, I had a happy child. How do you deal with that? You know? I mean, my parents were really nice people. They took care of us kids. All of us kids still get together for reunions. You know, we come from Iowa. You know, nobody died early. I mean, you know, it's awful. I mean, it would be an awful thing to have to try to, you know, come up with a good memoir from that. I can't think of anybody in my entire family who was deliberately cruel.
Well, that's a remarkable thing.
Yeah.
But that's worth writing about, and your time in Israel would be worth writing about, and you're a Pulitzer Prize winner, so, you know, that could be interesting to write about. I don't think you
I sort of don't think so.
I'm not going to talk him into it, right?
But it would make a good opening paragraph of a book to say, you know, I had the most tragic thing happen to me as a writer. My parents were really nice people, and they weren't mean to anybody. And, you know, like, what do you do with that? So
that's very true. If you read Walter, I keep coming back to Elon Musk, but if any of you read Walter Isaacson's biography, it's had really interesting reviews, but a lot of it talks about his childhood.
Did he have a bad childhood?
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, I think a person with Asperger's probably has a difficult childhood, regardless of how great his parents are,
yeah,
just because
probably.
It would be very difficult to, you know, to relate to other kids socially and so forth.
So how many people here remember John D. McDonald? Okay. How about Ross McDonald or Ross Thomas? Are those people? Okay. I asked that question because as I was walking back there, I noticed that Joe Ide has a book written about, it's not one of his...
It's Raymond Chandler.
Raymond Chandler. He
right.
wrote a Raymond Chandler book.
He did.
And I was thinking it'd be kind of interesting to write one book about...
each of the Rosses?
No, just continue their series.
Yeah.
And just write one in their style. That would be. I think it'd be kind of fun.
Denise Mina wrote a Raymond Chandler book, which is really different. I mean, she's Scottish, right? So her Raymond Chandler book, Where's Patrick? Because he and I did a program with her, I thought was absolutely fascinating. It had all kinds of great lines in it.
Did he have a lover who was famous?
Who, Chandler?
Yeah.
No, he drank.
Who was the other guy? Raymond Chandler and there was another...
Dashiell Hammett.
Did he have a lover who was...
Lillian Hellman, who was an author in her own
Lillian
right.
Hellman, okay.
Right. You came here for the classics, right?
Well, she was the one that was the enemy of Dorothy Parker.
Yes.
Okay.
Very true. And they got caught up in the blacklist, you know. I mean, I feel like, you know, I was born in 1940, and so I was in junior high school when the whole McCarthy thing started in the blacklist. And I remember I was a freshman or a sophomore at Stanford when finally it all went away. And I thought, that's never going to happen again in this country, that we're going to get, you know, this kind
of... talk about politics.
Kidding. I know, I keep coming back to it. But anyway...
what I remember about Dorothy Parker, actually, is that great line that if all the girls who went to the... Yale, all the girls who went to the Yale prom were laid end to end, she wouldn't be surprised.
She had a lot of great lines. You know, it's amazing. There are people who can, you know, most of us think of lines like that later, right? But Dorothy Parker was able, and Bennett Cerf, there was a whole group of them at the Algonquin Roundtable that could do that, right? Bennett Cerf went to Venice and he sent a telegraph back saying, streets full of water, advise. Which I've always loved. So, you know, they were great. So when you're writing Virgil, who has some great lines, you know, do they come easy to you or do you have to sit around and think up?
No, the thing is you get into this kind of a flow and they sort of just pop out. A lot of them do. And some of the lines I think aren't original, frankly. They're like riffs on lines I've heard someplace else, and so they're not exactly the same, but I was reading some website that has quotes from authors and the first one on the list of quotes from me was a guy saying, I'm so horny the crack of dawn ain't safe.
Are politics better than profanity?
What?
Oh, Lord.
And the thing is, I'm not sure that's original. It seems to me that I've heard that someplace, but I've never been able to track it down from other than the one. So
we just moved into R-rated territory. They're probably going to throw us off YouTube and Facebook. Oh, well, right.
I'm actually a very straight and sober person.
That's true. Very true. All right. So can we talk about the book that you were going to write that you're not going to write? Because I think it's quite a funny story. Okay. So, John, I got a text from John earlier this summer saying he was going off to Oxford to do some research, and could I put him in touch with somebody, which I did. And so what was the point of your
I was going to write, I've had a long-term interest in archaeology. I sponsored this dig in Israel, which cost an enormous amount of money for 15 years. And I went there and dug every year, and I was a dig photographer for a long time. And so this is how involved I've been in archaeology, pretty deeply involved. So one of the big controversies in the world of archaeology is whether the Brits should give back the Eglin marbles, which are in the British Museum. And so I thought, okay, here's a great idea. We have an American author, goes to England. He is attacked in his hotel room, and he inadvertently kills the attacker. And the British courts determined that he hit him twice, but that's not true. He only hit him once, but the guy whacked his head on a ledge back behind him in the hotel room around the edge of a fireplace, and that's what killed him. But they put him in prison for 5 years, and so he's in there unjustly imprisoned, and when he comes in, furthermore, he was engaged to a really beautiful woman, an actress that he had met during he's a very successful guy. His books are made into movies and all this kind of stuff. He comes out and he's a very bitter man, and he would like to strike back at England as an entire country at the same time if he could figure out a way to do it. And what he comes up with is he is going to help a disgraced Greek colonel steal the Elgin marbles back from the British Museum. I had a whole story worked out. You know, a plane flies in. They go in on Christmas Eve, which is the only day that the British Museum is closed. They cut the marbles off the walls. They load them up. They have people locked, the few people that were in the museum, they have locked in a room. I got the whole plot worked out. You know, they're flying out through, the jets over Europe, intercept them because they find out about it, and the plane refuses to land. Blah, blah, goes on. So, and then I signed up to make the key research trip to Oxford to do the final bit of research and look at stuff and go to the British Museum and look at stuff and the British Museum is in London, but I mean it was same all started the same kind of research, and I got there and I found out that the Elgin marbles actually weigh like 356 tons. And I thought we were talking about maybe five, because when I had gone to see the Elgin marbles years ago, what I remembered was a number of like figures that were mounted on a
They're friezes that go along the wall.
On a wall up above you, and you could cut those off and take them with you. But it turns out that that's only like 5% of the Elgin marbles. All the rest of them are up and down these hallways, and they're cemented in and stuff like that. And, 356 tons, are you kidding me? I mean, my gang was going to get in and out in 2 hours. And so I had to ditch the whole story. The other aspect of this, of course, is that I said, well, to my wife, I think I'm going to go off and do some research in London on the Elgin marbles. And she said, you want anybody to come with you? And so what started out as a fast in and out trip to London and Oxford turned into an expedition, there was a substantial upfront investment, let me put it that way. So what I did was I invented an entirely new book which required me to go to Oxford, which I am writing now.
In other words, the IRS would not look kindly on this trip.
Yes. The IRS is now going to take a hit, but what can I tell you?
Exactly. But I love that. I mean, right. So that seems to me might have been a basic question at the outset.
I thought I knew. Because, I'd gone in there and I'd seen these things around the wall. I said, well, hell, get a chainsaw and cut the suckers off. Nope, that's not the way it's going to work. So
So what was the title of that book going to be?
I think it was going to be called The Marbles. That was my idea. They hadn't told me at the company what it was going to be.
Oh, that's right. It wasn't going to be a prey book, right? It was a different character, right? So it didn't have to be like too heavy prey or something, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So have you gone down rabbit holes?
You know, heavy prey is not a bad title.
Yeah. Well, you can keep it for another book. Right? Yep. Have you gone down previous rabbit holes over the course of your career where you've had an idea
not like
just
that
didn't
one.
Work? No, this was the
not,
worst
not,
one.
Not, no, not
would
like that
taken,
one.
Would have taken, what, three B-57s or something to carry the marbles?
That's another thing is that I was talking to my neighbor who knows something about everything. And unfortunately, it's true. He's actually a CEO of a company that does a lot of stuff. And he said, you know, John, that would take 3 747s to lift that stuff out of them. And I said, that's a problem. You know, I was thinking 118-wheeler and a rented jet. So.
But have there been earlier attempts to write a book that have foundered upon reality?
No, not really. I mean, the book that I'm writing right now, the one that starts in Oxford, thank God, is a little bit of a fantasy. It's not exactly a fantasy, but you know, like if you have a serial killer loose in the Twin Cities or anyplace else, Texas, New Mexico, you know, Scottsdale, and Davenport is chasing him and eventually corners him and kills him, okay. So the people in Scottsdale will say, well, I didn't hear about this case, but I, you know, these things happen all the time that I don't hear about. Maybe I missed it in the newspaper. So there's a rational way of saying this could have taken place here and I just didn't know about it. And now I'm reading the story about it. The book I'm writing now takes place in Taos, New Mexico. Much of it does. But the entire town, and it takes place in 2023. It's very obvious from a lot of the stuff that it has to be 2023 because of road closures, construction at airports, all this kind of stuff that's going on right now that I went out and looked at, okay? But the problem is that the events that take place are so large that the entire town of Taos, which has got about 6,000 people in the town itself, are surrounded by hundreds of MPs, military policemen, state police, and cops. And the entire place is closed down, and there are checkpoints that nobody can get through. Okay, so then you read this book in 2024, and you say, you know, I was here, and none of this happened. And I would have noticed it because this is not Davenport going through on his own and catching somebody. This is a big national event. And so in a way, it's like a fantasy. And I don't know how people are going to accept that. But
I think you're overthinking that. I mean, it is fiction and it's okay, you know, if.
But it is a little bit different.
I don't know. I wouldn't have a problem with it if the whole city of Taos was shut down over, you know, whatever it was. You know, we recently had a very nice man who drove all the way here from Taos, New Mexico for one of our events. It's a long drive. But, so they only had 5,999 people in Taos at that moment.
Well, you would have taken him what? It would have taken you about 10 hours?
Yeah. Yeah. I can drive to Santa Fe in 7.5 if I don't stop much. So, right. So somewhere around in there. Right. I mean, have you been to Taos? Yeah, it's a beautiful town, isn't it? But very small. And yeah. Anyway, how about questions? Because we can't really talk too much more about Judgment Prey. You've got the basic idea, right? The judge and the two boys are killed. And Lucas, because of the senator saying to him, you know, we need you to fix this because he's a federal judge. Right?
Yep.
And Virgil gets assigned and off we go. Yes, ma'am. You had a question.
You know, no, not that way. But there have been some odd things happen along the route. For example, I once had a sort of a perverted guy who would take Polaroid photographs of his personal equipment, let me put it that way, and would leave them laying in shopping centers so that because he knew that most women walking by a photograph that was faced up would have to pick it up and look at it, so that instead of exposing himself, he was doing it one step past that. Okay, so I write this. This is like a joke in one of the books. Get a call from a Key West cop saying, do you know this guy? Because somebody had been doing it. Then there was the BTK killer in Kansas. Have you ever heard of him? The buy and torture kill thing? He told the cops he was a fan of the John Sanford books and that he liked that. Then there was the case in North Carolina. Have I told this story? Guy's driving down a road. Here's a barrel, one of those metal barrels, and it's on fire, okay? Well, maybe that happens a lot in North Carolina because he didn't pay any attention to it and just kept going. And he came back, and here's the damn barrel still burning, and he thinks, you know, that's odd. I better take a look at it. And he looks in it, and what he sees are a couple of feet like this, okay? And so he thinks he better call the cops, and he does. And the cops take this woman's body out of the barrel, which is half burned. They identify her as the wife of a guy who was having an affair. And the guy, they thought the guy probably killed her. And one of the clues was that she was wrapped in a very distinctive bed sheet, which, you know, had a printed pattern on it. And if they could find that bed sheet, that, you know, they could nail it down. Well, they never did find the bed sheet. But they put a lot of pressure on this guy, the husband, and his girlfriend. One of my favorite characters is the girlfriend, who thought, uh-oh, we're in trouble. And she fled for the state border, thinking that would help. And because she was the kind of person she was, she took her goldfish with her in a big plastic bag. And so she fled for the border with her goldfish. But at any rate, which the cops saw was unusual, they caught her and brought her back. So at any rate, they then, because there's so much pressure on them, they then get a note that said, you will never catch us because we're operating under the rules of John Sanford set down in the Rules of Prey. So the cops called me up and said, could you send us a book? And I said, yeah, I'll send you a book right away. And I've never been to North Carolina at this point. And the interesting outcome for this case was that they found the typewriter that the message was typed on, and it was typed on a guy who was not involved, they don't think was involved in the murder, but was a friend of the guy who think they did the murder. And so he wrote this letter for them on his typewriter and sent it off, and they charged him because they could get him, but not the other guy, not the killer. They charged him with accessory to first-degree murder, and they convicted of him, and they sent him to prison for life, and the guy who did the killing never got caught.
Oh. Don't type letters for
anybody. That guy back there. You're talking through Patrick. You got to speak
That's
up.
Your thoughts on who would have the look and the attitude to play Lucas and Virgil?
I'm not good at movie star names, but the guy, there was a time when he could play him. He played a male model in that movie where there are two male models kind of. I can't remember the name of the movie. Yeah, it was a comedy with a couple of big movie stars in it. Zoolander, the blonde guy.
Owen Wilson.
Owen Wilson could have played Virgil, I think.
Virgil, not Lucas.
Yeah,
definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
But he would have to kind of tone down his act because he's kind of got this Owen Wilson act that goes on, you know, he kind of a stupid guy. He can fix that, but he had the right look. And then the other guy, whose name I can't remember, but played in Hotel New Hampshire as the young kid. Nobody remembers the Hotel New Hampshire. I can't remember his name, but he's a tall, really good-looking guy. But he's so good-looking, you'd have to beat him up a little bit. But that's not really a problem in the movies. You could do that. But the other guy that I thought of is the former basketball coach for the Miami Heat, Pat Ryan. if you know who Pat Ryan is, you know, because he had those nuclear suits that he was always wearing, and always going around like this, you know, and doing this. I thought that he had the general look, you know. Rob Lowe is the guy I'm trying to think of. If Rob Lowe is, he doesn't look it, but he's actually a big guy, but he's very pretty. You'd have to do some stuff to him to make, you know.
Got a question over here.
Yes, you mentioned something about eventually stop writing. Would you ever pass the torch on to somebody like Lee Child did or someone else to continue?
No, I wouldn't do that.
Okay, good, good.
Thank you. Well, you know, it's interesting. We've got books in this store. I mean, these people have been dead for 10 years or 20 years.
There are a lot of continued, you know, series.
But they don't say Tom Clancy, who's been dead for 10 years. The actual writer's name is at about 4-point type, about this big, but it says Tom Clancy across the top. This lady.
Why is it that a lot of the writers are now...
You got to talk into this because I can't hear you.
I noticed Patterson and all of them are writing with other writers, co-writing. Why is that?
Why do they write it with...
You know, there's another...
They write with co-writers. Well, part of it is that there's no way that he could actually write that many books all by himself.
Are you talking about people like Preston and Child who are partners?
No, she's talking about Patterson.
Because there's a lot of money involved. I mean, these people have estates, and they're dead, so they don't have an opinion. Pardon me?
James Patterson.
Grissom is writing with other co-authors.
They do it because they would like to write an extra book. Steve Barry is an example. Steve took on a book with Grant Blackwood in June. He wanted to write about another character, but he didn't have enough time or enough energy to write his own regular series. Well, no, they're not quite the same, but that's just some writers make that decision. But that's different than a legacy writer, what John is talking about. Sherlock Holmes is a great example, or Agatha Christie. You know, there are still books being, Sherlock Holmes books. When the copyright expired, it meant that everybody could...
Well, you know, but the other thing is, the other thing is, like I was saying, who reads John D. MacDonald and who reads Ross Thomas and Ross MacDonald and all those guys back then? I'm a fan as well as being a writer. I mean, I was a big fan of John D. MacDonald. I think I could write a really good Travis McGee book, and it would be fun to do. And I don't think I'd make very much money at it, but I think it'd be a lot of fun. And I think it'd be a lot of fun to write a Ross Thomas book.
That's what you meant about Joe E.D. writing a Raymond Chandler.
Yeah, I don't think Joe did that, you know, to make a lot of money. I think he did it because he is a Raymond Chandler fan, and he lives in Los Angeles, and that's prime territory. It'd just be fun. Well, you know?
Yeah, Robert Parker wrote a Chandler. John Banville, I think it was.
Parker wrote a Chandler, and then a lot of other people wrote Robert Parker's.
It's still going on. As a matter of fact,
he died in like 2007.
We have a Spencer coming from Mike Lupica in December, I think it is. So, yeah, but part of that, I mean, John's right about the money, but a lot of that is fans. It makes fans very unhappy when a writer dies and then the character dies along with the writer. That can be a real blow to a lot of fans. So, you know, you can keep it going. It's a personal choice that every writer... I just was harassing John at dinner about having a literary executor, for example, because if you don't, then you can't necessarily prevent other people from going on and writing your characters. So we have a little free clinic here, legal advice. But there are a number of authors who never thought about it that, you know, I've recommended that they look into it. It all depends on how you feel about having your characters live on after you. That's a personal decision. Patrick, are there questions from...
There's actually a comment about the Elgin marbles.
It's actually Elgin marbles.
Elgin?
It's a hard
Elgin.
G.
Okay, Elgin marbles. Linda says, supposedly the marbles were slated to be broken up to make streets, supposedly. And then she said, Elgin wanted to preserve their importance by creating plaster models. It was overwhelming. That's when he offered to buy them, crate them, and store them in a barn. Is that the public became interested? Elgin begged the government to use them, to start the museum, supposedly.
Well, there was a big, I know a lot about this, actually, but so let me tell you what actually happened. That Greece at that point was governed by Turkey. It was part of Turkey, a legitimate, well, not a great government, but nonetheless a legitimate government. And Lord Elgin was an ambassador to the port. And his wife got interested in his money. He was Scottish. He had a lot of money. And they wanted to preserve the Elgin marbles. And they actually bought them from that government and shipped them on a ship, unsurprisingly, you know, at that weight, back to England. So they're
back to Malta.
Yeah.
Where they stood, they were there for several years, I think.
Right. But the point is that, you know, the Greeks are arguing that the British just appropriated them. And the British argument is that they bought them. And, you know, the fact that it wasn't a Greek government then, it was a Turkish government, it's not really the point. It was the government. So that has a lot to do with why there's this big controversy. The other part of it is, you know, was there, could the Greeks take care of it? They've now built a museum at the Acropolis that is quite a state-of-the-art museum. I've been in it. And now they say, okay, we could actually take care of them. It's the same argument about the Rosetta Stone. Should it go back to Egypt, to the new museum in Cairo? Because now, in theory, they could look after it. So museum questions are all over the world, and there's a whole different bunch of factors involved. You know more about this than I do, but I just happen to know that about the Elgin marbles.
Yep. Well, that's all true. Yep.
Thank you. Do you want serious or fun?
What?
How about
a serious
both?
Question or fun?
I don't care.
Okay, we'll do serious first.
Okay.
Because you've written for so many years, is there anything about either yourself as a person or as a writer that you've learned that surprised you?
Only that I can keep it going this long. I started this in 1990, and I'd had a whole career before that, so that's a little bit surprising. But, you know, I don't know, it just seems like work to me. So, you're just going to work and coming back home.
And the fun question, though, that could have been it.
Yeah.
Virgil's nickname, I Love, how did that come about?
It just works out as kind of a, I don't know what the literary word for it is, but you know, it's just
alliteration.
What?
It's alliteration.
It's sort of alliteration, but alliteration has got to be more like, you know, once upon a midnight dreary as I pondered weak and weary. And one of the, so, you know, it just kind of pops up. It just kind of sort of popped up when I was writing. Well, you know, the thing is that in the first book, when that came up, he had been involved in a shootout at a gas station with a guy, and he had fired 25 shots at the guy, and the guy had fired 25 shots back, and the woman said something like, you know, boys here would have killed him, and he said there must have been some pretty mean boys or something like that, and she said, well, that fucking flowers was many of you. And so that's just where it came from. It became his nickname almost, you know, and he doesn't like it particularly, but it's just so sticky that's what people call him. So
very nice question, Christina.
Yeah.
Since the topic of collaboration was brought up earlier, any plans to do another one like Saturn Run with that
Gatine? No, you know, not really. The thing is that I read science fiction, but I'm not good at science. I mean, I'm okay with science, like most people, you know, who took physics in high school. But all the science in that book came from Katine. It didn't come from me. Katine and I got together because we're both photographers, and he's really a good photographer. He's written a few books on how to do really complicated chemical printing processes with film for film, and now does it digitally. But he's like in that world, he's famous, and he's also got a double major in physics and English from Caltech. So he, so you know, like he was radically qualified to do that. And I enjoyed doing that one book, but that's really out of the line of what I do. You know, the part that I wrote in there was all the stuff about, you know, what the kid said and what, you know, the photographer said and what the guy said and what the ship's captain said and what, you know, these other people said and all that stuff about the ship, which is pretty crucial to the story. That was all Catan. So, and I don't have another story like that that I really want to talk about or really want, you know, really want to tell, actually.
Were you here for that event, sir? It was really an interesting evening. I thought he was a fascinating guy. He looked sort of like an Old Testament prophet. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Catan. And I don't actually know what his birth name was. That's the only thing I've ever known him by, so.
Anybody else? Yes, sir.
1987, Virgil as a street cop, I believe. Did you envision the evolution?
Lucas is a street
cop? Huh?
You meant Lucas as a street
cop? No, he's talking about Virgil. Yeah.
No, I meant Davenport.
He meant Davenport.
No, you meant Davenport? No. I mean, you know, usually when you think about people who are kind of your models, because I'm a fan, like I said, I've been a fan all my life. People write series of 10 or 12 books. And so, you know, like, I just wanted to get a book published because I had to send some people to college. And well, really, seriously, it was about money. I'll tell you one other quick story. I won a Pulitzer Prize. The Pulitzer Prize at the time was $1,000. The newspaper gave me a $50 a week raise. There's another $2,600 right there. Okay, the University of Minnesota cost $12,500 a year in tuition if your kid lived at home, and I had two kids and a wife who all wanted to go to college at the same time. That's $36,000 a year. I needed money from someplace, and that was one of my. I mean, I was a good reporter, and I really enjoyed the work. And so the one of my basic impulses for doing this was money. And one of the reasons I did what I did was because, first of all, I'm a fan of that kind of fiction, and the other thing is I just spent, you know, 20 years on the street in Miami, and in the Twin Cities, talking to cops, looking at cops, looking at dead bodies, looking at, you know, so that I had that background for these books. So that's where that comes from. And I had, you know, if I could get one book published, I'd be happy. Then if I get three books published, I'd be happy. And then if I get seven books, that'd be a career. And so now I've got 58, 57, something like that. You know, I never thought, in my wildest dreams, I never thought that was going to happen.
So can you remind us who were the people with you in the Miami newsroom? Because I think that was a remarkable constellation of writers.
Well, it was, one of them was a woman named Edna Buchanan, who was kind of a famous cop reporter in Miami, heavily armed at all times, very smart, wrote some good fiction along the way, even outside the newspaper. But she was a heck of a reporter, and also Carl Hyacin, who I think some of you are going to know. Carl actually worked for me for a while, and when I was I spent a year or two as a city editor at the Fort Lauderdale Bureau, and I one time, desperate for stories, I sent Carl out to find out what happened to the horseshit at Gulfstream Racetrack, and he begged me not to send him, and I sent him anyway because I was desperate for copy, and the story wound up on the front page of the big paper, the whole paper, because Carl is sort of a genius, and it was sort of a great story, and it was my idea, but I couldn't have written it like Carl did. But we had a lot of people there who were really good writers. Most newspaper reporters could write the kind of books I do if they weren't. If they had the ability to focus for more than a day, and it's a truism that a lot of newspaper reporters have a first chapter of a novel in their desk drawer, because the first chapter of a novel is easy to write, but they just don't persist. That's the problem. And people talk to me who work for newspapers. What do? You know, to get this novel done, you just keep writing it. No, what do you really do? Just keep writing it. I had a friend who was sort of an inventor in Hollywood, and he was a sound man. People said, you know, how do you get to be, what do you do when you're a sound man? And he said, you point the microphone as close as you can without it being in the picture. And I say, no, what do you do to be a sound man? Point the microphone as close as you can to the actor without getting it in the picture. That was what he did, and he actually became sort of a famous inventor in Hollywood, and even got an Oscar for some of his inventions. But some things are so basic and so simple. How do you write a novel? You persist. You just keep doing it. You just don't stop. And then your first one won't sell. Then your second one won't sell. Maybe the third one sells and doesn't get such, you know, great sales. The fourth one will get better sales. The fifth one will get better sales, and so on. But you just have to persist.
Very true. Speaking of newspaper reporters, we finally got our Michael Connelly date, which is Thursday, November 9th.
So, Michael Connelly was a good reporter is a good writer. He is a really good writer, and he knows what he's doing.
Yes, ma'am.
What was the book that you took off on? What number book was it that you knew that this was going to go places?
I never really knew that until Rules of Prey. But the thing is that I wrote a couple books beforehand, pretty bad ideas, basically. And they didn't sell. And so then I sold the first kid book, and I got $15,000 for it, which was 1 year at the University of Minnesota. And then I wrote the next book, which was Rules of Prey. And my agent called me back and said that she had gotten a two-book contract for me for $400,000. And this was like in 1990, when that was more money than it is now, okay? And then she called me a couple days later and said that this movie guy had bought the rights for another 400. And so, like, this was probably 15 years pay from the newspaper, and, you know, like, from one book. And I was gobsmacked. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't. But, you know, the checks arrived, and I cashed them. So
send everybody to the University of Minnesota.
But the thing is that, I mean, you know, weird things happen in the literary world like that. The same thing happened to Stephen King, and he's written about it extensively. About, you know, he wrote, I think, The Shining, or maybe it was the one about the girl. Yeah, it was Carrie. Yeah, and the book sold, you know, 14 copies in hardcover, and they sold the paperback rights for $500,000. And you know, like, this was even earlier than mine. This was, like, back in the 70s. And he freaked out, you know, like, what the hell does this mean? You know, it's just like you won the lottery. So
publishing is totally unpredictable, and that's because you guys are unpredictable. It's almost impossible to judge, especially with a first novel, which ones are going to be. Although I can sort of tell by how much money the publisher is throwing at it. That's a clue. You know, over the years, Patrick and I have both been surprised, haven't we, by books that, you know, we like them. It wasn't, you know, that we thought they were bad books taking off, but we would. My favorite example is Where the Crawdads Sing. I actually had her here at the store. There was me and Delia and one other person. And, you know, I read 100 books, and if I'd really been smart or, you know, been a genius, I would have had like 10,000 books for her to sign.
Who is this?
Delia Owens, your publisher. I finally talked them into sending her here. But, you know, that wasn't a book that anybody expected to. It's just like, you know, Dan Brown, when he wrote the book before The Da Vinci Code, the name of which, what was it called? Angels and Demons, which was a, you know, I tried to persuade his publisher what a really great idea he had with the, what is it, that's Lincoln Child. An enigmologist. What is Dan Brown's guy? He has a, he's a title, he's a thing like that. I can't. Yeah, but I can't remember what his, yeah, but he has a thing like an enigmologist, but he's something very similar. Anyway, I could not persuade the publisher of Angels and Demons what a great idea. So he eventually took the Da Vinci Code to another publisher, and it just, you know, was a roaring success. But
took over the world for a while.
It did, but you would have thought that, you know, Angels and Demons, the first one, would have been the book that would do that, but no. So it's just, you know, it's almost impossible to judge what's going to take.
One of the things that's going on right now is everybody's jumping up and down about AI and artificial intelligence. And one of the interesting things about it is that they said, you know, all these jobs are going to disappear. You know, and one of the jobs you're talking about disappearing is mine. And I'm old enough that it doesn't worry me so much, but if I were 40, it would worry me. But we were talking a little bit about this at dinner time, and I think that most writers, like me, and like Stephen King, and like Michael Connelly, and like, Mick Herron, and people like this are, I don't mean to sound vain about this, but the writing has a certain charm to it. And I can't think of a better word. It's just a kind of a charm that the reader picks up and that the writer can produce and that they like, and it's almost undefinable. But when you see papers written by AIs, it lacks that. They are flat. They just don't know how to create the charm yet. They don't, and I don't know what other word you would use to describe what goes on, but when I read one of the people that I'm a fan of, it's always there, and you can usually pick up on it in the first page or so. It just feels right. And how do you define that to a computer? And they don't know how you can find it. They could write really good sentences. You know, they're grammatical and all that kind of stuff, but they're flat. So
maybe they just don't have a sense of humor. Dave Barry sat right here and said to me that an AI would never replace him because they don't have a sense of humor. I do remember the Dan Brown character. He's a symbologist. See, now I've just proved to you that when you're old, it isn't that your memory fails. It just takes longer. You could hear it whirring away there, you know. No, I'm really serious. You know, that happens. And, you know, it just proves you don't really forget things. It's just the retrieval system is overloaded. There we go. Is there anything from the audience finally, Patrick? All right. There was one more question.
A couple years ago, you posted a sample chapter of a new character. And then abandoned that. I think it was a guy with a dog. Can you tell us what was going on with
it? You know, that's still sitting on my computer, the front page of it.
The guy with the dog? That's a great title. Yeah.
Well, it's not the guy with the dog, but it's a German Shepherd. And our German Shepherd, never mind. But at any rate, I like the character. But I don't have a story for him, and I just kind of tired of inventing characters. But he also, in the end, struck me a little bit too much like a lot of the characters that I don't like in popular fiction now. I don't like military characters in general, and he was a military character. And the reason I don't like military characters is because I was in the military in the 60s, and I went to Iraq in the 00s, whatever we call those. And my experience of the military and my research with the military is not anything like the superheroes who go around and kill dozens of people, apparently without any feeling about who the people are or any conscience about it. And I don't think the military is like that. I think it's a misrepresentation, so it bothers me. So I had this guy who was going to be a lieutenant colonel. He was a lieutenant colonel when he retired because he's afraid they're about to make him into a colonel. And he was going to help out some friends of his who were basically non-coms. And I had developed parts of the story. And one of the parts was that this one non-com, his mother got ripped off by a scamming group, a computer scam group down in Miami, who convinced her to send money to something, and they ripped her off for all the money. And so this guy got his non-coms from Syria together, and they went to Miami. And what they found was that this was some kind of a foreign group, which I hadn't specified yet, but God help me, I think they might have been from the Ukraine. But they found that they had a huge amount of money there that they were just getting ready to ship out, so they stole all of it. And they had it in a rental truck that they were driving around the South, you know, Mississippi, Louisiana. They were hiding from these guys, and they wanted the colonel to come down and solve their problem because he was a problem solver. That's essentially what they wanted him for. So that's what the story was going to be about, you know, with some humor and crazy characters and gunfire and all that kind of stuff. But I just never got it done. And I like the dog character as much as anything, you know. The dog character is great.
There we go. Well, I want to thank you all for paying attention. I think we're all starting to squirm slightly. An hour in these chairs is about what we do. John?
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.